not 1 minute of his waking hours. His regimen was flexible but balanced. Any overindulgence in sport or flirtation would be immediately compensated for by extra study. When an attack of measles laid him low in February 1877, he made up for lost time by canceling his Easter vacation in New York, secluding himself on a friend's farm, and finishing in 5 days the first book of Horace, the sixth book of Homer, and the Apology of Socrates. It must not be assumed that Theodore struck any of the Harvard faculty as intellectually remarkable during this stage of his academic career. On the contrary, he was regarded as an average B-man, not in any way distinguished. He paled in comparison with the scintillating 16-year-old Bob Bacon, and at least half a dozen of his classmates surpassed him in composing themes. Roosevelt's writing was to the point, said one instructor, but did not have their air of cultivation. Like many voluble men, he was a slow writer, painfully hammering out sentences which achieved force and clarity at the expense of polite style. Neither this nor the pessimism of professors prevented him from scoring an average of 75 at the end of his freshman year, with honor grades in 5 out of 7 subjects. If it could not be counted a distinguished performance for a boy who had largely educated himself, then it would do for the time being. Before leaving Harvard for the summer of 1877, Theodore played host to several guests from New York, including Edith Carrow. The latter, perhaps aware that she had local rivals, flirted with him and his classmates so successfully that he exclaimed afterward, "I don't think I ever saw Edith looking prettier. Everyone admired her little ladyship intensely, and she behaved as sweetly as she looked." He begged Corinne to pass on the word that, "I enjoyed her visit very much indeed." But within a day or two, he was praising other girls again. When college broke up on 21 June, he hurried not to the parlors of New York City, but to the lonely forests of the Adirondacks, so as to get the birds in as good plumage as possible. Possibly Edith, hearing this, heaved a quiet sigh. She could compete with the belles of Boston, but what were her charms compared with those of the orange-throated warbler, red-bellied nuthatch, and hairy woodpecker? In mid-July, Theodore joined his family at Tranquility, and soon afterward published his first printed work, The Summer Birds of the Adirondacks. This scientific catalog was the fruit of 3 expeditions dating back to August 1874, on the last of which he had been briefly joined by Harry Minot, his best friend from Harvard. Minot contributed a few observations and was listed as co-author, but the title page typography left no doubt as to who took full credit. 97 species, some unknown even to longtime residents of the area, were described in precise thumbnail sketches, remarkable for their emphasis on song as well as plumage. Theodore's acute ear had been ravished in the Adirondacks by a wealth of melody such as he had never heard before. His notebooks, upon which Birds was based, are so full of auditory observations that visual ones are sometimes forgotten. Spectacles or no spectacles, sound always meant more to him than color. One rhapsodic passage shows how sensuously he reacted to it. "Perhaps the sweetest bird music I have ever listened to was uttered by a hermit thrush. It was while hunting deer on a small lake in the heart of the wilderness. The night was dark, for the moon had not yet risen, but there were clouds, and as we moved over the surface of the water with the perfect silence so strange and almost oppressive to the novice in this sport, I could distinguish dimly the outlines of the gloomy and impenetrable pine forests by which we were surrounded. We had been out for 2 or 3 hours, but had seen nothing. Once we heard a tree fall with a dull, heavy crash, and 2 or 3 times the harsh hooting of an owl had been answered by the unholy laughter of a loon from the bosom of the lake. But otherwise, nothing had occurred to break the death-like stillness of the night. Not even a breath of air stirred among the tops of the tall pines. Wearied by our unsuccess, we at last turned homeward, when suddenly the quiet was broken by the song of a hermit thrush. Louder and clearer it sang from the depths of the grim and rugged woods, until the sweet, sad music seemed to fill the very air and to conquer for the moment the gloom of the night. Then it died away and ceased as suddenly as it had begun. Perhaps the song would have seemed less sweet in the daytime, but uttered as it was, with such surroundings, sounding so strange and so beautiful amid these grand but desolate wilds, I shall never forget it. This Keatsian passage, composed when Theodore was only 18, foreshadows the best of his mature writing in its simplicity and atmospheric effects. Yet he kept it and other such effusions strictly private. In his published works, he seemed determined to be scholarly. Summer Birds was followed in due course by a similar study, Notes on Some of the Birds of Oyster Bay. 35 years later, when the ex-president was writing his memoirs, he would look back fondly on these obscure ornithological publications which formally launched him on his career as a professional natural historian. That career was the subject of a solemn discussion between father and son during the late summer of 1877. Theodore's courses in his freshman year had all been prescribed. Now, as his sophomore year loomed, he could choose some of his own and begin to follow his future course in life. Summer Birds, which was favorably reviewed, must have convinced Theodore Sr. that his son was already one of the most knowledgeable young naturalists in the United States. The boy's collection of birds and skins, now numbering well into the hundreds, was probably unequaled in variety and quality by any American of his age. He was regarded as a very promising taxidermist, appeared in a national directory of biologists, and very likely had no peer, as a teenage ornithologist, in his knowledge of bird coloration, courtship, flight, and song. His future as a scientist would therefore seem to be assured. Yet Theodore Sr. gave him surprisingly little encouragement.
My father told me that if I wished to be a scientific man, I could do so. He explained that I must be sure that I really intensely desired to do scientific work, because if I went into it, I must make it a serious career. That he had made enough money to enable me to take up such a career and do non-remunerative work of value if I intended to do the very best work that was in me, but that I must not dream of taking it up as a dilettante. He also gave me a piece of advice that I have always remembered, namely, that if I was not going to earn money, I must even things up by not spending it. As he expressed it, I had to keep the fraction constant, and if I was not able to increase the numerator, then I must reduce the denominator. In other words, if I went into a scientific career, I must definitely abandon all thought of the enjoyment that could accompany a money-making career, and must find my pleasures elsewhere. After this conversation, I fully intended to make science my life work.
Returning to Harvard as a sophomore in the fall of 1877, Theodore elected two courses in natural history, elementary botany, and comparative anatomy and physiology of vertebrates. His instructor in this course, which he found extremely interesting, was William James. He also chose two courses of German and one of French, and was prescribed courses in rhetoric, constitutional history, and themes. In this demanding schedule, he was to surpass the record of his freshman year with an excellent average of 89. He scored 96 and 92 in German, 94 in rhetoric, 89 in botany, and 79 in anatomy. His average would have been even higher, but for a hair's breadth 51 in that villainous French. Even so, with 6 honor grades out of 8, he once again confounded his academic critics, and there was no more talk of scholastic mediocrity. He distinctly belonged, said Thomas Perry, instructor in themes, to the best 25 in a very brilliant class. With respect to the other 220, Theodore gradually relaxed his rather snobbish standards. My respect for the quality of my classmates has much increased lately, he wrote Corinne, as they no longer seem to think it necessary to confine their conversation exclusively to athletic subjects. I was especially struck by this the other night when, after a couple of hours spent in boxing and wrestling with Arthur Hooper and Ralph Ellis, it was proposed to finish the evening by reading aloud from Tennyson, and we became so interested in memoriam, that it was past 1 o'clock when we separated. His best friend continued to be Harry Minot, but as time went on, he showed an increasing fondness for Richard Saltonstall, a large, shy boy from the highest ranks of Boston society. With Bob Bacon, too, he maintained an easy friendship, and was invited with him to join the prestigious Institute of 1770. About the time he turned 19, in October 1877, Theodore was informed that his father had been appointed collector of customs to the Port of New York by President Hayes. He dutifully expressed the greatest interest in subsequent movements toward confirmation by the Senate, but the interest was personal rather than political. Since his appearance at the Hayes demonstration a year before, he had shown no further concern for politics. His letters of the period, so full of bubbling curiosity about other aspects of life, are bare of any reference to national affairs. Now, however, events conspired to force politics brutally upon his attention. Theodore Sr., who had himself just turned 46, was as politically naive as his son. He assumed at first that the collectorship was a reward for distinguished services to New York City, but disillusionment came rapidly. President Hayes, it turned out, had chosen him merely as a symbol of the administration's commitment to civil service reform. By elevating this decent and incorruptible man up to public office, Hayes hoped to embarrass Senator Roscoe Conkling, boss of the corrupt New York State Republican machine, who was demanding the reappointment of Chester A. Arthur as collector. The fact that Arthur was himself decent and incorruptible only increased the savagery of the resultant battle for Senate confirmation. Roosevelt lay helpless as a pawn between the clashing forces of old guard spoils men and reform Republicans. Since Boss Conkling happened to sit on the Senate committee that must consider the appointment, it was subjected to endless delaying tactics. Yet Hayes would not withdraw his nomination, and Roosevelt, as a patriotic citizen, had no choice but to remain at the president's disposal. He loathed Conkling with all his soul, and felt contaminated by any contact with the machine. Theodore Sr. belonged to a class and a generation that considered politics to be a dirty business, best left, like street cleaning, to malodorous professionals. Humiliated by the scrutiny of his inferiors, exhausted by week after week of worry, he began to deteriorate physically under the strain. He was racked by mysterious intestinal cramps, which worsened as the struggle dragged on into December. By then, the collectorship row was making nationwide headlines, and while the nomination seemed doomed, suspense continued to torture the nominee. His son, following daily developments in Cambridge, grew increasingly worried. "Am very uneasy about father," he wrote on 16 December, after the nomination had been finally rejected in the Senate by a vote of 25-31. "Does the doctor think it is anything serious?" 2 days later, Theodore Sr. collapsed with what was diagnosed as acute peritonitis. For a while, he lay desperately ill, but as Christmas approached, he began to recover. The Roosevelts celebrated with exhausted relief, vowing to have no more to do with politics. Back at Harvard, early in the new year, Theodore recorded in a private diary his father's parting assurance that after all I was the dearest of his children to him. As always, the deep voice and all-seeing eyes inspired a determination to be worthy of the best and most loving of men. He was cramming hard for his semi-annual examinations when, late on the afternoon of Saturday, 9 February, an urgent summons arrived from New York. Theodore ran to catch the overnight train, knowing that his father must have suffered a relapse, yet unaware that screams of agony were echoing through the Roosevelt townhouse. Theodore Sr.'s peritonitis was in reality a malignant fibrous tumor of the bowel, and since its brief period of remission over Christmas, it had grown so rapidly that it was now strangling his intestines. The pain that he suffered had, in a matter of weeks, turned his dark hair gray. Even now, as his elder son rushed to his bedside, it was all the other children could do to hold him down. "He was so mad with pain," Elliot recorded, "that beyond groans and horrible writhes and twists, he could do nothing. Oh, my God, my father, what agonies you suffered!" Theodore arrived on Sunday morning to find the flags of New York City flying at half-mast. Greatheart had died shortly before midnight. Alone in his room later that day, the new head of the Roosevelt family drew a thick slash down the margin of his diary for 9 February 1878 and wrote, "My dear father, born September 23, 1831. Here his pen wavered and stopped. When Theodore resumed writing on 12 February, the words flowed tumultuously, as if to wash away his grief. "He has just been buried. I shall never forget these terrible 3 days, the hideous suspense of the ride on, the dull, inert sorrow, during which I felt as if I had been stunned, or as if part of my life had been taken away, and the 2 moments of sharp, bitter agony
When I kissed the dear dead face and realized that he would never again on this earth speak to me or greet me with his loving smile, and then when I heard the sound of the first clod dropping on the coffin holding the one I loved dearest on earth, he looked so calm and sweet. I feel that if it were not for the certainty that, as he himself has so often said, he is not dead but gone before, I should almost perish. None of the Roosevelts, least of all Theodore himself, could have foreseen how shattered he would be by the premature loss of his father. He was everything to me. For a while it seemed as if the youth could not survive without him. Like a fledgling shoved too soon from the bough, he tumbled nakedly through the air. Some of his diary entries are not so much expressions of sorrow as squawks of fright. They give the impression of a sensitivity so extreme it verges on mental imbalance. For month after month, Theodore pours a flood of anguish into his diary, although his letters remain determinedly cheerful. Only in private can he allow his despair to overflow, yet the effect is therapeutic. By the end of April, he is able to note, "I am now getting over the first sharpness of grief." With perhaps unconscious symbolism, he shaves off his whiskers and in consequence is endlessly chaffed by the boys. On the first day of May, with the smell of spring in the air, he is surprised to find that his thoughts of Theodore Sr. have suddenly become pleasant ones. His grief, however, was by no means over. It continued to flow well into the summer and spasmodically through the fall. Purged of terror, it became sweetened with nostalgia. Memories of his father surfaced in the form of dreams and hallucinations of almost photographic vividness. "All through the sermon," he wrote on Sunday, "I was thinking of father. I could see him sitting in the corner of the pew as distinctly as if he were alive, in the same dear old attitude, with his funny little warlike curl and his beloved face. Oh, I feel so sad when I think of the word never." Never. It was the word he had repeated over and over again in his childhood diaries when longing for the unrecoverable past. Inevitably, his earliest and most poignant memory floated up. "I remember so well how years ago, when I was a weak, asthmatic child, he used to walk up and down with me in his arms for hours together, night after night, and oh, how my heart pains me when I think that I never was able to do anything for him in his last illness." This, of course, was not his fault. Early news of Theodore Sr.'s relapse had actually been withheld from him so as not to affect his studies, but it did not stop him reproaching himself, often in tones of bitter self-contempt. "I often feel badly that such a wonderful man as father should have had a son of so little worth as I am. How little use I am, or ever shall be in the world. I realize more and more every day that I am as much inferior to father morally and mentally as physically." After the terror and the nostalgia, it was desire that eventually healed him. Longing for the man who had been his best friend in life was translated into an even more desperate longing to be worthy of him in death. "How I wish I could ever do something to keep up his name." In this ambition, he would succeed so well that the name of Theodore Roosevelt would one day become the most famous in the world. Ironically, its very luster would obliterate the memory of its original bearer. But the large, kindly spirit of Theodore Sr. hovered always over the shoulder of his son. Years afterward, Corrine recalled, when the college boy of 1878 was entering upon his duties as President of the United States, he told me frequently that he never took any serious step or made any vital decision for his country without thinking first what position his father would have taken on the question. On 23 February 1878, his first night back at Harvard after the funeral, Theodore noted casually, "I am left about $8,000 a year, comfortable, though not rich." No doubt as he penned these words, his mind harked back to the conversation he had had with Theodore Sr. the previous summer, when he had been promised enough money to subsidize his career as a natural historian. Now here it was. It had arrived shockingly soon, but his duty was clear. Grief or no grief, he must balance the numerator of independence with the denominator of work. With remarkable self-discipline, given the hysteria of his private emotions, he at once resumed his studies and within a week had scored 90% in two semi-annual examinations. Invitations poured in from sympathetic friends in Boston,
but he would accept none until May, and kept grinding like a Trojan for the rest of his sophomore year. At the same time, he continued faithfully to exercise and teach in Sunday school, obedient to a precept of his father's, which he had never forgotten. Take care of your morals first, your health next, and finally your studies. The excellence of his results in the annual examinations was achieved at much physical cost to himself. He was unwell and feverish during the latter part of May, and blamed his poor showing in French on being forced to sit up all night with the asthma. The ordeal was over at last on 5 June. Theodore caught the afternoon express to New York, and next morning began what he hoped would be a summer of nude happiness among the wilds of Oyster Bay. Nude the summer certainly was, at least in the restricted Victorian sense of the term. Theodore was soon mahogany from the waist up, thanks to hours of bare-chested rowing. But happiness was long kept at bay by unavoidable associations between Tranquility and Theodore Sr. In every idle moment, the skinny student might see the big, bearded man laughing, praying, snoozing in the shade, jumping into his trap at the station and driving off at a rattling pace, his white linen duster bagging behind him like a balloon. "Oh, Father, how bitterly I miss you and long for you." Just as he had distracted himself in college with work, Theodore now whipped himself into a frenzy of physical activity. Throughout July, he rode and portaged such exhausting distances over such dreary wastes of water and mud flats that just to read his diary is to tire. On one occasion, he rode clear across Long Island Sound to Rye Beach, a total of over 25 miles in a single day. Rowing, as opposed to the more leisurely sport of sailing, was deeply satisfying to him. As Corinne remarked, Theodore craved the actual effort of the arms and back, the actual sense of meeting the wave close to. Yet he loved riding even more, and spurred his horse Lightfoot to prodigious feats of endurance, including one 20-mile gallop. In between rows and rides, Theodore would burn off his excess energy by running at speed through the woods, boxing and wrestling with Elliot, hiking, hunting, and swimming. His diary constantly exults in physical achievement, and never betrays fear that he might be overtaxing his strength. When forced to record an attack of cholera morbus in early August, he precedes it with the phrase, "Funnily enough." Evidence that his heart, if not his body, was repairing itself came on 9 August. "It being Edith Caro's 17th birthday, I sent her a bonbonniere." The young lady made her annual appearance at Oyster Bay a week later, and Theodore paid her his usual attentions, rowing her to Lloyd's Neck, lunching out at Yellow Banks, and picking water lilies with her in Cold Spring Harbor. Without reading more into the diary than is actually there, it is possible to discern the mounting excitement he felt in her proximity. On 22 August, he let off steam by thundering off on a wild ride that I am afraid may have injured my horse. Later the same day, Edith joined him for a sailing trip, and in the evening they went to a family party together. Afterwards, his diary entry concludes, "Edith and I went up to the summer house." With this enigmatic remark, a curtain of blank paper descends, and Edith is not mentioned again for months. Whatever happened in the summer house, it seems to have kindled some sort of rage in Theodore. Only 2 days later, he was bothered, while riding, by a neighbor's dog. Drawing his revolver, he shot it dead, rolling it over very neatly as it ran alongside the horse. On a cruise up Long Island Sound with some male cousins, he blazed away with the same gun at anything he saw in the water, from bottles or buoys to sharks and porpoises. With the first chill of fall in the air, Theodore's thoughts turned again to Harvard and to his future. The uncertainty he had felt ever since committing himself to a scientific career was beginning to worry him, so much so he turned to an uncle for reassurance. But the old gentleman, while sympathetic, was unhelpful, and Theodore's bewilderment increased. "I have absolutely no idea what I should do when I leave college," he wrote in despair. "Oh, Father, my Father, no words can tell how I shall miss your counsel and advice." As if to seek refuge from his doubts, he decided to spend the last few weeks of his vacation in the wilds of Aroostook County in northern Maine. Arthur Cutler had hunted in the area, one of the last stands of virgin forest in the northeast, and had suggested that Theodore might like to do the same. There was a backwoodsman there, said Cutler, named Bill Sewell. He kept open house for hunters and was emphatically a man to know. Huge, bearded, and full of lust for life, Sewell loved to shout poetry as he fought his canoe through whitewater or slammed his axe into shuddering pine trees. No doubt Cutler sensed that this magnificent specimen of manhood might satisfy Theodore's cravings for a father figure. And since Sewell was humbly born, he might rub off some of the boy's veneer of snobism before it toughened into impenetrable bark. Island Falls, where Sewell had his headquarters, was so remote from New York City that Theodore took 2 full days to get there, completing the last 36 miles in a buckboard. 2 cousins, Emlyn and West Roosevelt, and a Dr. W. Thompson, accompanied him. The strain of the journey, coming on top of his frenetic summer, caused him to suffer a bad attack of asthma, and when he arrived at Sewell's homestead, late on the evening of 7 September, he was wheezing. Sewell's first impression of him was a thin, pale youngster with bad eyes and a weak heart. Dr. Thompson took the backwoodsman aside. "He's not strong, but he's all grit. He'll kill himself before he'll even say he's tired." Sewell agreed that Theodore looked mighty pendlin', but soon found out that his appearance was deceptive. "We traveled 25 miles afoot one day on that first visit of his, which I maintain was a good fair walk for any common man. We hitched well, somehow or other, from the start. He was different from anybody that I had ever met. Especially, he was fair-minded. Besides, he was always good-natured and full of fun. I do not think I ever remember him being out of sorts. He did not feel well sometimes, but he never would admit it. I could see not a single thing that wasn't fine in Theodore, no qualities that I didn't like. Some folks said that he was headstrong and aggressive, but I never found him so except when necessary. And I've always thought being headstrong and aggressive, on occasion, was a pretty good thing. He wasn't a bit cocky, as far as I could see, though others thought so. I will say that he was not remarkably cautious about expressing his opinion." Theodore, for his part, found Sewell to be a figure straight out of the saga of King Olaf. The backwoodsman agreed. "I don't know but what my ancestors were Vikings." Tramping through the woods together, they were an oddly matched yet complementary pair. Sewell, slow and purposeful, advancing with bear-like tread, Theodore, wiry and nervous, cocking his gun at any hint of movement in the trees, stopping every now and again to pick up bugs. Since both men loved epic poetry and could recite it by the yard, the squirrels of Aroostook County were entertained to many ringing declamations, including Sewell's favorite lines. "Who are the nobles of the earth, the true aristocrats, who need not bow their heads to kings, nor doff to lords their hats? Who are they but the men of toil, who cleave the forest down, and plant amid the wilderness, the forest and the town?" The words may have been familiar to Theodore, yet falling from the lips of a man whose father had been a carpenter and whose mother a seamstress, they took on new, defiantly democratic overtones, which were not lost on the scion of the Roosevelts. On 27 September 1878, Theodore was welcomed back to Cambridge by his classmates, and to his surprise, was offered the Porcellian. Membership in this club was the highest social honor Harvard could bestow, and he was acutely embarrassed to refuse it. His scruples had nothing to do with the possible disapproval of a Bill Sewell. It was just that he had already been offered the A.D. and had accepted that instead. Greatly regretting his hastiness, for he wished very much to be a pork man, he turned to the more important business of choosing a schedule for his junior year. It proved to be an ambitious one, covering 9 subjects and at least 20 hours a week of classroom and laboratory work. His electives were once again German and 2 natural history courses, zoology and geology, plus Italian and philosophy. Those prescribed were themes, forensics, logic, and metaphysics. In this formidable curriculum, he was to score the best marks of his academic career, averaging 87 and standing 13th in a class of 166. In 2 of his electives, philosophy and natural history, he stood first. No sooner had Theodore settled down to his familiar routine of recitations, study, exercise, and sprees than the Porcellian once more opened its doors to him. Early in October, there happened to be a drunken quarrel in the yard, during which a pork man told an A.D. man that Teddy Roosevelt, given the chance, would have chosen his club first. When the taunt became public, the AD announced that as its new member had not yet signed in, he was free to reconsider his acceptance. "Of course, by this arrangement, I have to hurt somebody's feelings," Theodore wrote agitatedly in his diary. "I have rarely felt as badly as I have during the last 24 hours. It is terribly hard to know what the honorable thing is to do." He decided that honor lay in the direction of the more prestigious club, and accepted the Pork's offer on 6 October. "I am delighted to be in," he told Bammy. "There is a billiard table, magnificent library, punch room, etc., and my best friends are in it." Perhaps the best of these best friends, now that Harry Minot had dropped out of Harvard to study law, was Dick Saltonstall, whose family mansion on Chestnut Hill became a second home to Theodore in the fall and winter of 1878. The first invitation to this bastion of Boston society came on Friday, 18 October. The two young men drove out of Cambridge in Saltonstall's buggy, crossed the river, and headed west into a brilliant fall landscape. Chestnut Hill lay 6 miles away. As the buggy creaked toward it, through increasingly luxuriant woods, Theodore could sense the waves of peace and security which flow around the enclaves of the very rich. A private lane curved up the hillside to where Leverett Saltonstall's house lay, huge and rambling, backed by chestnut trees, and fronting on an immense sweep of lawn. The lawn was shared by another equally imposing mansion, the home of George Cabot Lee. A mere 20 yards of grass and a token garden gate separated the one property from the other. Dick had doubtless already explained to Theodore that the Lees and Saltonstalls were more than mere neighbors. Mr. Lee was his uncle by marriage, and 17-year-old Alice Lee was the inseparable companion of his sister, Rose Saltonstall. Theodore met both girls that evening. In his diary, he described them with his usual vague adjectives, sweet, pretty, and pleasant, the last being reserved for Rose, who was decidedly the more homely of the two. He greatly enjoyed himself that weekend, walking through the woods with Alice and Rose, attending church with both families on Sunday morning, and chestnutting alone with Alice in the afternoon. As always, his soul responded to people of his own class, conversation on his own level, manners whose every nuance was familiar to him. Only a month ago, Bill Sewell had convinced him that the nobles of the earth were men of toil, and probably would convince him again as he intended to return to Island Falls one day. But in the meantime, the Lees and Saltonstalls were aristocracy enough for Theodore Roosevelt. On 27 October, as his second decade came to an end, the young man's thoughts turned to the past, and his grief for his father surged up afresh. To distract himself, he took a ramble through the woods with his gun. His diary entry for that night proves, with unconscious humor, that his heart had at last healed. "Oh, Father, sometimes I feel as though I would give half my life to see you but for a moment. Oh, what loving memories I have of you. Two gray squirrel." On 2 November 1878, Theodore was initiated into the Porcellian. It seems the honor rather went to his head. "Was higher with wine than ever before, or will be again," he wrote. "Still, I could wind up my watch." Then, in a revealing afterword, "Wine makes me awfully fighty." A throbbing hangover confirmed his lifelong resolve never to get drunk again, and the evidence is he never did. He continued to enjoy sprees at the Pork, including the traditional suppers of partridge and burgundy, and champagne breakfasts on Sundays. But he remained severely teetotal on most of these occasions, and abstemious on the others. As for smoking, he had promised his father to abstain from that manly practice until he was 21, with the result that when the time came, he had lost all interest in it. The third vice that appeals to most undergraduates was beneath his contemplation. He remained perfectly pure throughout his bachelor years. His second visit to Chestnut Hill occurred on 11 November, when he drove over to take tea with the Saltonstalls and their ubiquitous visitor from next door, who was as sweet and pretty as ever. So, of course, was practically every girl that Theodore met. But Alice Lee seems to have merited his praise rather more than any other. When he saw her again, he was a house guest for Thanksgiving, and already so much a part of the Chestnut Hill circle that she allowed him to call her Alice. As her own first Teddy lingered softly in his ears, he vowed, with all the strength of his passionate nature, that he would marry her. Chapter 4. The Swell in the Dog Cart. A little bird in the air is singing of Thyri the fair, the sister of Svend the Dane. And the song of the garrulous bird in the streets of the town is heard, and repeated again and again. Hoist up your sails of silk, and flee away from each other. Alice Hathaway Lee was just 17 when Theodore first saw her on 18 October 1878. As long as I live, he wrote afterward, I shall never forget how sweetly she looked and how prettily she greeted me. With his photographic memory, he no doubt carried that first vision of her pristine to the grave. Alice blushing must indeed have been an unforgettable sight, and not only to eyes as worshipful as Theodore's. Contemporary testimonials to her beauty are as unanimous as those in praise of her charm. She was an enchanting creature of singular loveliness, of quick intelligence, endearing character, and unfailing sunny temperament. She was gay, exceptionally bright, and the life of the party. Images of sunshine and light recur so often in descriptions of her that one can understand how quickly she bedazzled Theodore, as indeed she bedazzled everybody. The imagination, stimulated by such universal praise, delights to picture Alice Lee coming through that garden gate more than a century ago. An exquisite, willowy blonde, smiling shyly, moving with the long, firm step of a natural athlete. She wears a dress of white brocade that glows in the late afternoon light. Through Theodore's spectacles, as it were, we see, as she draws nearer, that she is tall, 5'7", only 2 inches shorter than he, yet holds herself proudly erect. Her hair, drawn up to expose a graceful neck, is honey-colored, but when the sun strikes the water curls that cling to her temples, or the thick ropes piled high on her head, unexpected highlights of gold shimmer in it. Her eyes are similarly chromatic. At times they seem a very pale blue, at others a pearly gray. Heavy lashes, when she glances down demurely, brush cheeks whose pinkness, blending into a soft pocket of shadow in the corner of her mouth, make her irresistibly kissable. She is, in short, as ravishing a beauty as ever walked across a Boston lawn or through the pages of any Victorian novel. Theodore, drinking her in at every pore, fell in love with her there and then. Just 2 more meetings were enough to convince him that win her I would, if it were possible, and to affirm that I had never before cared a snap of my finger for any girl. So much for Edith Carroll. Theodore, when he wrote those words, was in such rapture over Alice that he probably exaggerated his indifference to other women. But whatever spark Edith had kindled in his heart was obliterated by the firestorm of passion which now consumed him. After only 1 weekend at Chestnut Hill, he could afford to be sarcastic about his childhood sweetheart. "Give my love to Edith, if she's in a good humor. Otherwise, my respectful regards." The suspicion grows that his last interview with that strong-willed young lady in the summer house at Oyster Bay had been a stormy one. "If she seems particularly good-tempered," Theodore went on, "tell her that I hope that when I see her at Xmas, it will not be on what you might call one of her off days." With that, he cast her from his mind and dedicated himself to the eager, restless, passionate pursuit of one all-absorbing object. Given her extreme youth and the protective aura of wealth and privilege that had always surrounded her, Alice not surprisingly proved to be as elusive a prize as Theodore had ever hunted. His ardor was so violent, in courtship as in everything else, that he periodically frightened her away, like a nervous doe. Then he would have to restrain himself, and with soft words and soothing gestures, coax her near again. She found him by no means a romantic attraction. The slight stench of arsenic that emanated from his clothes, the tickly whiskers and glittering glasses, the manic bursts of energy which left him white and sick with exhaustion, his geyser-like garrulousness, choked by stammers which would inevitably explode under the pressure of more words boiling up inside him, his exuberant hopping on the dance floor, so perilous to lace pantaloons, the blood-curdling stories of wolves and bears, the black eyes from boxing, the nervous diarrhea, the alarming hiss of asthma in his lungs, these were not the things a girl of polite background dreamed about, except perhaps in nightmares. Yet Alice could not help being intrigued by him and flattered by his adoration. How different he was from those boring young Boston Brahmins, and so far as she knew, from everybody else in the human race. How side-splitting he could be when he told jokes in that curious falsetto of his. Her quick mind rejoiced in his intelligence and her body, when they skated together, to the masculine hardness of his arms. Even as she sprang away from him, she took care not to spring too far. Not that there was any risk of him abandoning the chase. Theodore, like his father before him, almost always got what he wanted. No sooner had the lovesick junior returned to Winthrop Street after Thanksgiving than he formally entered in his diary the vow that he would marry Alice Lee. To make it doubly formal, he arranged a tintype spree, or trip to the photographer's, so that he might pose beside his beloved at the very onset of their courtship. Clearly, it would be improper to suggest that Alice come to the studio alone, so Rose Saltonstall was roped in as a convenient third party. There is more than a hint of nervousness in Theodore's first letter to Alice, reminding her of their rendezvous. Even at this stage, he seems afraid that his doe might wander. Porcellian Club, December 6, 1878. Dear Alice, I have been anxiously expecting a letter from you and Rose for the last 2 or 3 days, but none has come. You must not forget our tintype spree. I have been dexterously avoiding forming any engagements for Saturday. Tell Rose that I never passed a pleasanter Thanksgiving than at her house. Judging from the accounts I have received, the new dress for the party at New Bedford must have been a complete success. Your fellow conspirator. Alice did not forget, and the group portrait, so momentous to Theodore, survives. Bewhiskered and slim as a reed, he sits between the two girls, carefully clutching his hat and cane. Alice, seated lower, leans toward him, almost touching his right thigh. Her skirts droop sexily over his shoe. She wears a lace-fronted dress and high-feathered hat. Her gray eyes gaze dreamily into the camera. She seems unaware of the giant resolve looming next to her. By now, Alice Lee was occupying Theodore's thoughts through every waking hour, and would continue to do so, according to his own testimony, for the next year and a quarter. At times her girlish waywardness would drive him to despair. In one particular moment of frustration, he ripped the pages containing the Thanksgiving vow bodily out of his diary. There is a suggestion of sexual torment in Theodore's entry for 11 December 1878, when he asks God's help in staying virtuous, as his father would have wished, and to do nothing I would have been ashamed to confess to him. I am very... Here the eager researcher turns the page, only to find a huge blot of ink. Somehow its very blackness and monstrous shape convey more of Theodore's misery than whatever words he had scribbled beneath it. Such fits of depression were, however, rare in the early days of his courtship. Teddy continued to be welcome at Chestnut Hill, and Alice was quick to atone, with a soft word or look, for any bruise she may have inflicted upon him. At any such sign of favor, he positively radiated with joy, and would exult, when alone with his diary, in his youth, his social and academic success, and the luck which had led him to Chestnut Hill. Truly, he wrote as 1878 passed into 1879, these are the golden years of my life. It must not be supposed that Theodore's obsession with Alice Lee caused him to neglect his studies, or that he ceased to partake of the clubby delights of Harvard. I have enjoyed quite a burst of popularity since I came back, he boasted in a letter home, having been elected into several different clubs. Apart from the pork and its partridge suppers, he attended regular meetings of the Institute of 1770 and its secret caucus, the old, merry, brutal, ribald, orgiastic, natural, wholesome Dickey. He presented papers to the Harvard Natural History Society on such subjects as the gills of crustaceans and coloration of birds. He lectured learnedly on sparrows at the Nuttall Ornithological Club, whose middle-aged members, discomfited by his knowledge, accused him of being vain and cocksure. He was put up for the hasty pudding early in the new year, and won election as fifth man in the first nine. When his instructor in political economy asked him to form a finance club, he not only did so immediately, but wrote a joint paper with Bob Bacon on municipal taxation, and presented it at the club's inaugural meeting. We little suspected, wrote Professor J. Lawrence Laughlin many years later, that we were being addressed by a future President of the United States and his Secretary of State. Thus, in February of 1879, Theodore Roosevelt revealed that the political animal within him was at last beginning to stir. About the same time, he made his first public speech at the annual dinner of the Harvard Crimson. It was an awkward effort, yet vividly remembered by William Roscoe Thayer. Since entering college, I had met him casually many times and had heard of his oddities and exuberance, but throughout I came to feel that I knew him. On being called to speak, he seemed very shy and made what I think he said was his maiden speech. He still had difficulty in enunciating clearly or even in running off his words smoothly. At times he could hardly get them out at all, and then he would rush on for a few sentences as skaters redoubled their pace over thin ice. He told the story of two old gentlemen who stammered, the point of which was that one of them, after distressing contortions and stoppages, recommended the other to go to Dr. X, adding, "He cured me." A trifling bit of thistledown for memory to have preserved after all these years, but still it is interesting to me to recall that this was the beginning of the public speaking of the man who later addressed more audiences than any other orator of his time, and made a deeper impression by his spoken word. Although Theodore continued to dream of being a natural historian when he left college, he confessed that the prospect of 3 extra years of overseas study, a necessary academic requirement, made him perfectly blue. Politics, on the other hand, was beginning to appeal to him so strongly that he asked Professor Laughlin if he should not perhaps make that his career instead. Laughlin replied that the halls of American government were much more in need of idealistic young men than were zoological laboratories. Still, Theodore clung to his imagined vocation until a softer, more influential voice persuaded him to abandon the Chimera forever. Whether it was the prospect of losing her beau to some foreign university for 3 years, or simply his distressing tendency to produce creepy crawlies, Alice Lee did not relish the idea of Theodore becoming Professor or Dr. Roosevelt. Her disapproval of his collecting was probably the reason for a startling remark he made to Harry Minot at the end of his sophomore year. "As you know, I don't approve of too much slaughter." Much later, Theodore himself admitted that courting Alice brought about a change in my ideas as regards science. Their intimacy ripened slowly during the early weeks of 1879. There were polite teas with the Saltonstalls and dances at the Lees, winter walks and coasting parties, Alice occasionally allowing him to share her toboggan, on the crisp slopes of Chestnut Hill. "I like the two girls more and more every day," he told Bammy, "especially pretty Alice." Determined to make himself as irresistible as possible, he nurtured his reddish whiskers to the size of powder puffs and grew increasingly resplendent in his dress, with high glossy collars, silk cravats, and cameo pins, fobbed watch chains, and coats rakishly cut away to show off the uncreased, cylindrical trousers of a man of fashion. Toward the end of February, Theodore began to suffer from a surfeit of polite conversation. The drawing rooms of Chestnut Hill suddenly became claustrophobic to him. He decided to clear his head and his lungs with another vacation in Maine. When he reached Mattawamkeag Station on 1 March, Bill Sewell was waiting in a sleigh to escort him to Island Falls, 36 miles away. For hour after hour, as they hissed north over a 3-foot shroud of snow, Theodore marveled at a landscape wondrously changed from the one he had explored 6 months before. "I have never seen a grander or more beautiful sight than the northern woods in winter," he told his mother afterward. "The evergreens laden with snow make the most beautiful contrast of green and white, and when it freezes after a rain, all the trees look as though they were made of crystal." At Island Falls, he renewed his acquaintance with Sewell's nephew and partner, Wilmot Dow, whom he had met only briefly the previous September. Dow, just 23, was as big a man as Sewell, and by the latter's admission, a better guide, better hunter, better fisherman, and the best shot of any man in the country. In time, this impassive, smooth-faced youth would become as good a friend to Theodore as his uncle. For the first few days in Aroostook County, the sub-zero temperatures troubled Theodore's asthma, or guffling, as Sewell called it. But after a pung trip to a lumber camp at Oxbow, even deeper in the wilderness, he breathed clear again and enjoyed every minute of his stay. The Aroostook lumbermen, many of whom were unlettered and had spent all their lives in the woods, were the roughest human beings he had yet encountered. Sewell noted how he charmed them and held their interest. Of course, he did not understand the woods, but on every other subject he was posted. The reason that he knew so much about everything, I found, was that wherever he went, he got right in with the people. Theodore enjoyed them immensely. He told me after he left the camp how glad he was that he had met them. He said that he could read about such things, but here he had got first-hand accounts of backwoods life from the men who lived it and knew what they were talking about. Even then, he was quick to find the real man in very simple men. No doubt the emerging politician got great satisfaction out of his ability to converse on equal terms with backwoodsmen as well as Boston Brahmins. He asked Bill Sewell, as he had Professor Laughlin, whether he should go into science or politics after he graduated. "You may laugh, but I have a presentiment that sometime I may be president." More intent on the here and now, Theodore the Hunter exulted in chasing a caribou for 36 hours through the snowy forest, with neither tent nor blankets to protect him. The naturalist collected specimens, while the sometime invalid worked up enough health to last me till next summer. Last but not least, King Olaf trapped a lynx, and swore that its fur would soon warm the pretty feet of his beloved. In mid-March, Theodore was back at Harvard, doing double work to make up for my holiday. Within a week, he had breezed through his semi-annuals with an average of over 85, and could turn once more to the courtship of Alice Lee. Determined to re-enter her life in dramatic fashion, he chose as his stage the floor of the college gymnasium. The occasion was the spring meeting of the Harvard Athletic Association on 22 March 1879. T. Roosevelt Jr., weighing in at 135 pounds, was entered for the semifinal bout of the lightweight boxing championship against W. W. Coolidge at 133 and a quarter pounds. The winner would presumably take on the defending champion, C.S. Hanks, entered at 133 and a half pounds. Theodore, who was known to possess a wicked right hand, had given Coolidge a tremendous thrashing the year before, no doubt hoped to repeat the performance now for the benefit of Alice Lee. She sat in the gallery with a party of other Boston girls, prettily wrapped in furs, for the gymnasium was freezing. The first bout went well for Theodore. According to the Harvard Advocate, he displayed more coolness and skill than his opponent, and had no trouble in dispatching Coolidge. There was a ripple of delicate applause from the gallery, and he retired to sponge off for the final bout. When he came out, Hanks, who had duly won the other semifinal, was waiting for him. Again, to quote the Advocate, a spirited contest followed, in which Mr. Hanks succeeded in getting the best of his opponent by his quickness and power of endurance. These terse words might have been the only record of the afternoon's fighting, except that some students in the audience were so impressed by Theodore's performance that they talked about it the rest of their lives. One of them was the future novelist Owen Wister, destined, like William Roscoe Thayer, to become a biographer of the skinny figure in the ring. His description of the bout has made it perhaps the most celebrated episode in Theodore's Harvard career. We freshmen on the floor and those girls in the gallery witnessed more than a spirited contest. Owing to an innocent mistake of Mr. Hanks, we saw that prophetic flash of the Roosevelt that was to come. Time was called on a round, Roosevelt dropped his guard, and Hanks landed a heavy blow on his nose, which spurted blood. Loud hoots and hisses from the gallery and floor were set up, whereat Roosevelt's arm was instantly flung out to command silence, while his alert and slender figure stood quiet. "It's all right," he assured us eagerly, his arm still in the air to hold the silence. Then, pointing to the timekeeper, "He didn't hear him," he explained, in the same conversational but arresting tone. With bleeding nose, he walked up to Hanks and shook hands with him. According to another spectator, Hanks said good-naturedly, "Hadn't we better stop?" Theodore shook his head like a terrier, bared his teeth, and began punching again. The rest of the bout was distinctly gory. It was plain that the smaller man was outclassed. Hanks had a much longer reach. His eyesight, moreover, was normal, whereas Theodore was obliged to box without spectacles. "It was no fight at all," another student remembered. "You should have seen that little fellow staggering about, banging the air. Hanks couldn't put him out, and Roosevelt wouldn't give up. It wasn't a fight, but, oh, he showed himself a fighter." One wonders if Alice Lee, shuddering into her furs, admired the bloody Theodore as much as his classmates, however. At any rate, he succeeded in drawing himself to her attention again. As soon as his cuts and bruises healed, she accepted an invitation to a little lunch party in his rooms. Five other girls and college boys were present, under the benign chaperonage of Mrs. Saltonstall. The lynx rug was presented with great ceremony. Alice announced that she would make Teddy a pair of slippers. Their relationship was moving into an intimate, more serious phase, and Mrs. Saltonstall surely reported this fact back to Chestnut Hill. But the Lees did not seem to fear losing a daughter who, at the tender age of 17, had yet to make her debut. With spring sweetening the air, and Alice growing increasingly receptive to his advances, Theodore decided to pay court to her on horseback, in the style of a true gallant. Lightfoot was accordingly shipped to Cambridge. All at once, Chestnut Hill seemed so much closer that Theodore took to galloping over the river almost daily, looking, in his own words, very swell, with hunting crop and beaver. He took long walks with Alice, taught Alice the five-step waltz, played whist with Alice, told Alice ghost stories, wrote endlessly in his diaries about Alice, Alice, Alice. The very shape of the word as it uncurled from his pen seemed to give him pleasure. All through April and May, he overflowed with happiness as intense as his grief of the previous year. "What a royally good time I'm having! I can't conceive of a fellow possibly enjoying himself more." By rising early and working before breakfast, Theodore was able to pack 6 to 8 hours of study into the first half of the day, leaving his afternoons and evenings free for romance. Although he defined this as a life of most luxurious ease, poor Lightfoot cannot have agreed. The animal was not only thundering constantly along the hard road to Chestnut Hill, but had to help Theodore work off his exuberance afterward with marathon gallops through the countryside. When, on 13 May, Theodore was invited to dinner at the Lees, he whipped Lightfoot up to such a pace that he nearly killed both horse and himself. "I rode like Jehu, both coming and going, and as it was pitch dark when I returned, about 10:15, we fell while galloping downhill, a misadventure which I thoroughly deserve for being a fool." For weeks it seemed that the crippled horse might not recover, and Theodore was obliged to visit his beloved on foot, a 12-mile tramp every time. By early June, however, he was once again in the saddle, pausing only to register a preoccupied 87% in his annual examinations. Theodore braced himself for the final phase of his courtship of Alice Lee. It was now or never. Only 2 weeks remained until Harvard shut its doors for the summer. Then, for almost 3 months, he would be hundreds of miles away from her, while other suitors, perhaps, strolled the lawns of Chestnut Hill. Alice had already given disturbing hints that she liked to flirt. If he did not secure her by class day, she might be wooed away. It comes as a surprise to flick through Theodore's diary for these momentous final weeks of his junior year and find no hint of crisis in its bland pages. Since ripping out his written vow to marry Alice, he had begun what was to become a lifelong habit, that of simply not recording what was ominous, unresolved, or disgraceful. Triumph was worth the ink. Tragedy was not. Until Alice was his, he would continue merely to list the trivial details of their relationship, so that if he failed, posterity would not know it, and even he, in time, might forget his aching desire for her. His letters home are just as guarded, although one cannot help but admire how subtly, since the new year, Theodore has made the Roosevelts aware of Alice Lee and prepared them, subconsciously as it were, for his possible engagement. Casually, he suggests the entire family might like to come up to Harvard for class day, 20 June. "I want you particularly to know some of my girlfriends now." How convenient to have both them and the Lees at hand, should he wish to make an announcement, at the conclusion of his junior year, at the blossoming climax of spring. Although it is not certain that Theodore asked Alice to marry him on class day, he afterward confirmed that he proposed to her sometime in June, and his unerring sense of place and time would seem to make the evening of the 20th inevitable. He had been tense as a wire the night before, at the DKE strawberry festivities. "I got into a row with a mucker and knocked him down, cutting my knuckles pretty badly against his teeth." But now his mood was tranquil. Never had he spent such a pleasant day. Never had Alice looked sweeter or prettier. He had ushered at Saunders Hall in the morning, lunched at the Pork, ushered again at the Flower Rush, then escorted Alice to 2 tea parties in succession. No doubt much of the student body had admired the tall, honey-haired girl strolling around with that fellow with whiskers and glasses. Now in the twilight, they sat together watching the sway of tinted lamps in the yard, and listening to the songs of the glee club. Words, whispered perhaps, passed between Alice and Theodore. At 10 o'clock, when the singing ended, they walked over to Memorial Hall and danced till nearly midnight. Then it was time for Alice to go home.